All right, here we go. Better late than never. Didactic Mind, episode 12. The stupidity tax. The point of today's podcast is to explore how living in the dirt world is akin in many ways to having a significant tax placed upon your time, your resources, your income, if you will. And in some ways, that tax is actually measurable. And I want to explore over the course of the next hour or so how it affects daily life and your ability to get things done in an environment where things don't really work the way you expect. And if I have time, I'll talk about how that translates into where the West is heading across pretty much every major Western country right now, and what that portends for the future. Very, very warm welcome to all of my readers, my loyal readers from the blog, didactsreach.blogspot.com. Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. If you have not subscribed already, please do so as soon as you can, because that way you will never miss another upload. And speaking of missing uploads, the reason why this one is a bit late is essentially because I've had to deal with family relatives coming over and staying over, and that's kept me very, very busy for the last few days, if not last 2 weeks almost. They were only here for a few days, but given the nature of said relatives, it was a bit hectic. And the funny thing is, I wasn't even the one bearing most of the brunt. It was really my mom, unfortunately. I do feel sorry for her, but she was kind of in her element, you know, doing the things that she loves, entertaining people, cooking, and really cooking a ridiculous amount of food. So we got loads of food, loads of leftovers, which I suppose is how it should be. But that's all beside the point. The goal of today's podcast is to illustrate the ways in which you can essentially see how stupidity manifests itself around you when you're living in an undeveloped or underdeveloped country. And the inspiration for this comes from a set of things that I've been reading from readers of my blog and from people who I read myself and respect greatly. There was an article that I wrote very recently called, it was about Africa. It's called, where is it? The Africa Conundrum. I can't believe it, you know. It's only been a few days, but it's called The Africa Conundrum. And in it, I essentially pointed out that the West's attempts to save Africa from itself are utterly and totally misguided. It's absolutely pointless attempting to fix Africa, because Africa cannot be fixed. It doesn't matter how many tens of billions of dollars of aid you pour into Africa to try to raise these poor benighted people out of their poor benighted status. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to work. Why is that? Well, I outlined a few different reasons. The first and most important of which is that the Africans themselves have no desire to fix their own problems. And this is not just me saying it, and I realize the moment that you touch Africa or Africans in any way, shape, or form, you're automatically accused of being a racist. This isn't racist at all. This is just the observable daily reality of life in an undeveloped, underdeveloped, dirt world, dirt poor country. Africans simply have no capacity or ability to save themselves. And again, these are crude generalizations, I'm well aware of that. There are always the odd exceptions. That's a very good thing when those exceptions are able to do what they need to do to fix their own lives. Ooh, there's a rather good-looking dog out there wagging its tail. Anyway, I have an excellent view from where I am, so it's a nice morning. Well, right now it's morning for me outside, and I've got a really beautiful view out to a hut where somebody's doing some sweeping, and there's a rather good-looking golden retriever, just sitting out there. Anyway, the point is that Africans aren't able to fix their own problems because they don't have the ability to think for the long term. Africa is very much, for those of you familiar with RK selection theory, Africa is very much an R-selected society. The races and the tribes and societies there, the cultures there, are dedicated to what is known as a live fast, die young strategy. And this isn't just me talking on my ass, because there is significant scientific evidence to support this. There was an article some time ago published about the prevalence of dementia among men of African descent, and the fact that it hits them much younger and much more quickly than it does whites and Asians. There is evidence that Africans are more prone to certain types of genetic disease than whites and Asians. There is no question that as a race, Africans, or people of African descent, are prone to things that whites and other races are not. This is not racist. This is scientifically true. This is simply me stating facts. I am not casting judgment upon them for this. There's nothing to judge. It's just what is true. So the problem that Africans face is that they live in a culture and in an environment where life really is cheap. And I've never been there, so I don't understand what it's like, but I have readers who have lived in Africa, who live in Africa right now. I've got one reader who's living there, I believe, right now. And he has his own blog. He writes about what it's like living in such an environment. I'm not going to say where he is. You can go find his blog yourself. But he essentially talks about how just foolish and ridiculous daily life is. And the only way to get around this is to laugh at yourself, to laugh at what the absurdity of everything around you. This is backed up by multiple anecdotal accounts. If you read the work of Adam Piggott, my friend, the Gentleman Adventurer, and he is a friend, he's a really good dude. If you haven't subscribed to his podcast, please do so. And he's a guy I have enormous respect for. He's been through some very, very hard times in his life. He spent a couple of years in Uganda, I believe it was, guiding river rafts down quite difficult rapids. And he wrote a couple of books about it. His first one, Pushing Rubber Downhill, is the one that he's probably best known for. And that's the one where he talks about his experiences in Africa itself. And he is not complimentary. The things that he saw and the things that he experienced in Africa every day really wore him down. It wore everybody down. They wore everyone down. And that is not to say that Africa was entirely bad or terrible, because it wasn't. He talks routinely about the good times, good experiences that he had, the very cheerful and happy nature of local Africans, the laughing children and their very effusive embrace of daily life. And these are wonderful things to see. This is one of the things that makes Africa a nice, or I wouldn't say nice, but a welcome change of pace from perhaps more stolid, dour, introverted, withdrawn societies of the West, particularly Scandinavian countries. I mean, if you've ever been to any of the Scandi countries, you'll realize very quickly that they're quite cold fish. They're actually very warm people once you get to know them. but they're very, very introverted, very withdrawn. And the same is true of Russians. You know, I've spent about 6 months in Russia total so far. And I love the Russians. I think they're a wonderful people. But they can be pretty cold when you meet them. They're hard to get to know. The moment that they trust you, you're their best friend for life. They will literally take the shirt off their backs for you to keep you warm. That's the kind of people that the Russians are. Africans are a bit different. They are in their own way. They can be good people, and they often are. But they don't have that same long-term strategy, that same long-term thinking. And again, this is not a criticism of them. It's just, it is what it is. And it's not unique to them either. I mean, you see this around the world. You see this in multiple countries outside of Africa. You see it in a number of Islamic countries as well. It's, you know, in South Asia, in the Middle East, to some extent. The reason why I'm talking about Africa and the African situation is simply because it serves as a base of illustration, a base from which to demonstrate other points which apply more widely to other countries. So, as Adam and his older compatriot, not compatriot, but fellow writer, fellow traveler, Kim Dutoit, have pointed out, Africa is a place that really wears you down because life is cheap, life is short, and because the locals just aren't interested in fixing things. Adam talks about how the sheer stupidity, unrelenting idiocy of the place wore people down every single day they were there. They just couldn't deal with, eventually, how dumb things were, how inefficient they were, for entirely avoidable reasons. Kim Dutoit talks about the same thing in his classic 2002 post, Let Africa Sink, in which he basically said that there's not much point in trying to solve Africa's problems, because Africa will always win out in the end. There's no point fighting the way that things are in Africa. The sheer size and mass and population of the place makes it impossible to fight the corruption, the nepotism, the stupidity, the rank, the profligacy, the theft, the rampant disregard for private property, for the sanctity of the rights of the individual. There's no point. There's absolutely no use in trying to fight it, and there's even less use in trying to save it from itself. And this is the part that always gets do-gooder Westerners absolutely infuriated. They're like, how can you possibly be this cold and callous? How can you possibly say that there is nothing worth saving? That's not what we're saying. What we're actually saying is there is stuff worth saving. It's just that Westerners can't do the saving, so stop trying. There's no point in pouring $100 billion+ worth of aid into a country, or into a continent, excuse me, and watching 70%+ of it get siphoned off into the pockets of corrupt officials and presidents and kings and dictators, and watch the rest get frittered away and wasted because of endemic corruption at every level and extreme backwardness. You know, where for instance you try to send out aid packets to distribute to the starving villagers in Somalia or Ethiopia, Eritrea, or Zimbabwe, for instance. And they just get stolen. And the local tribal chieftain won't let you distribute to his people. Why? Because as Adam once pointed out, that would mean that the tribal chieftain is not all-powerful. So he'd rather see his people starve than receive aid. And that's not a made-up story. Adam has actually witnessed that himself. This is daily reality over there. So why is it that there is so much corruption and stupidity going on. Well, a big part of it is, as I pointed out in my article, because of the lower than average, the low average IQ, in particularly sub-Saharan Africa. Northern Africa is different because of the admixture of genetics up there. So there's quite a lot of Arab influence in particularly North Africa. There's a lot of Phoenician influence. The genetics have changed significantly because of all of the empires that have come through, conquered Northern Africa, occupied it, stayed there, you know, made institutional changes that have had positive benefits. If you look at Northern African IQs, they tend to be anywhere from half to one standard deviation higher than Sub-Saharan African IQs. Sub-Saharan African IQ is in the about 70. Now, this is extremely unpleasant for Western liberals to hear, but it's true. That level of IQ, depending on which scale you use, if you use Stanford, Binet, or Wechsler, it's essentially two standard deviations to the left of the mean, whatever that is, the average IQ. However you define the scale. But what the findings have consistently shown is that sub-Saharan African IQs are roughly, pretty much, two standard deviations to the left of the global mean. That puts them borderline on retardation by human standards. And Western liberals have enormous trouble trying to reconcile this with what they see every day when they go to Africa, because they see happy, smiling, you know, effusive, extroverted people. Okay, you know, they have a very hard time realizing that does not mean that these people are necessarily capable of complex, technologically oriented tasks. That's just the reality. It's not a pejorative statement. It's just what is. And their average IQ stays that low for a number of reasons. I mean, one of the key factors that affects intelligence is nutrition when you're growing up. If you have an entire continent that is afflicted with very poor, unstable, low protein nutrition, by definition, you're going to get a low intelligence population. That's simply what's going to happen from having an unstable, unreliable, low nutrition, low nutritive value food supply. Can't be avoided. Education, of course, has some impact on IQ. I mean, most of it is genetic, but there is some impact on intelligence due to basically working out your brain cells as you grow up. So when you have a poor base for education, of course, your average IQ is going to be low. And you know, there are lots of other factors that affect it. I mean, you know, the rates of disease, infant mortality, access to healthcare. As I mentioned, nutrition is a big one already. There are any number of factors which impact or affect the average IQ of a society. And when those factors are missing, the question is, what do you do about it? Well, you could try to introduce them exogenously, but that's not going to work if the frameworks for upholding them don't exist, okay? And I'm going to get to why this is important shortly, because this is a lesson that applies throughout the world, not just in Africa. So when you have this problem of being unable to maintain your infrastructure, essentially the social and physical capital necessary to support a high IQ population, inevitably you get a low IQ population. And inevitably, this is just my theory, it's not inevitable perhaps. This is just what I have observed. So take it with a large grain of salt, because I've traveled a lot, I've seen a lot of things, but I'm not omniscient. In my opinion, and only in my opinion, once a society gets below a certain average IQ threshold, just like once it gets below a certain average total fertility rate, you know, number of births per woman, I don't think there's a way of saving or pulling back that society. I don't believe it's possible. And that's simply because I've never observed it to happen myself. I've never observed a society to bring itself back from the brink after reaching a particular point. Now, again, I could be wrong. There are probably examples out there, which I just haven't seen, of societies where there was a massive drop-off in IQ, in overall intelligence and social capital, and yet the population figured out a way to re-establish civilization, and in some cases, restore it to beyond the point of its predecessors. The Dark Ages come to mind, for instance, where, after the fall of the Roman Empire, well, what we mistakenly call the Dark Ages come to mind, because the real Dark Ages didn't take place until about 300 years later from the point that they were supposed to. But after the fall of, the official fall of Rome in 476 AD, it used to be that a lot of historians would say there was a Dark Age that swept across Europe. The reality is that in daily life, pretty much nobody noticed that the Roman Emperor or the Roman Empire was gone. Why? Because the Roman Empire had effectively ceased to exist as a power source or structure for about 100 years before that. So people had already adapted. And the civilizations of the former Roman vassals in Spain and France in particular, modern Spain and France, had already reestablished Christianized Visigothic kingdoms. And the average wealth and stability of those societies greatly increased right up until the point of the first wave of Islam, the first expansion of Islam in the 7th century. And that's where the true Dark Age took place. That's really when it happened. Building on the work of Henri Pirenne, a great French, a maverick French archaeologist and anthropologist who pointed this out. So, I'm not convinced, though, that the average IQ of Europe necessarily declined below the point of recovery. I don't know, because there have been no genetic studies. It's not possible to do genetic studies on that sort of thing. So we just don't have the evidence, as far as I can tell. If we do, please somebody correct me. If I am wrong, I will freely admit it. I mean, I'm happy to be wrong in this case. The key here is to understand that once, again, just in my opinion, once a population goes below a certain threshold of IQ, it doesn't really recover, and it can't really move back up to the next stage. If it's possible, great. I'd love to be proven wrong. And I hope that I am proven wrong. I genuinely do, because I don't want to be so black-pilled about things. But the reason why I keep coming back to this IQ issue is not because I believe IQ is purely deterministic. It's not. There are plenty of societies around the world where the average IQ is like 80. And yet they're fully functional. They're in Colombia comes to mind. Fred Reed pointed this out in one of his columns a couple of years back, where he really took on the HBD crowd and said this obsession with IQ as a measurement of living standards and human achievement is nonsense, because there are so many counterexamples where you can see that the average IQ of the population is very low, comparatively speaking, compared to Western or East Asian norms, and yet they have fully functional societies. They can do, they can exist in technologically advanced cities, and it's not anarchy. It's not collapsed into chaos and violence. It's not Mogadishu all over again. And he brings up Colombia as an example, where the average IQ is measured to be about 80, and Colombia is very much a bastion of Hispanic civilization. I mean, once you get past the drug war that's been raging there, and which basically now has been rather ruthlessly and effectively suppressed, then you realize pretty quickly that actually Colombians know what they're doing, and it doesn't hurt that they have some of the most beautiful women in the world, of course. Just saying. So, IQ is not purely deterministic. It's not. And I accept that. There is no doubt in my mind, however, that it has a significant role to play. And with that, I want to go move on to the broader subject of why it is that IQ is important in general terms. Because let's broaden our horizons a bit and look away from Africa, where we know that things can't really be fixed. Let's look at other countries, you know, in the third world, particularly in South Asia. And let's take a look at, let's say, India, all right, where you really feel the tax of stupidity wearing on you. And this is, I found, universally true throughout the dirt world. Wherever you go in underdeveloped or undeveloped countries, almost wherever you go, this is not universally true, but in most underdeveloped and undeveloped countries, what you're going to find is the sheer amount of stupid really, really wears you down. And it gets to the point where you just can't look away anymore. You find it profoundly depressing. Let me give you a few examples of what I mean. If you're in certain parts of India, you're going to find that the road systems don't work very well. The forms of ID that you need don't work particularly well. There is so much redundancy and red tape and unnecessary bureaucracy that really doesn't need to be there. And it's there for no good reason. It's there basically just to give people something to do. But it imposes a massive tax upon the productive, the diligent, the hardworking, the intelligent, and the ambitious. So, let me give you a few examples. When you're driving down the roads in parts of India, you're going to find that there is no such thing as road markings. Like the rules of the road don't exist. I mean, this is something very simple, right? Driving is a simple action. Pretty much anybody can do it. It's essential to modern life. If you're in the USA, you cannot imagine, once you're outside of the big cities anyway, you know, the top five cities, you cannot imagine going through life without driving. You absolutely need a car because the USA is just so bloody huge. To get anywhere, you have to get anything done in the US, you have to drive. And driving is a wonderful experience, but it's only wonderful if you're driving on good roads. It's only wonderful if you're driving on roads where the road markings are clearly defined, and where the traffic signals are well understood, and the other users of the road respect the law and generally stay in their own lanes and don't make a huge nuisance of themselves. In India, all of these things go straight out the window. Basically, the experience of driving down a road in India is absolutely harrowing. It's a terrible idea to do it because your blood pressure will go straight through the roof. You'll be clutching the wheel going, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, because the distances between cars are much narrower. The idea is that, you know, the Indian mindset is that if there's a gap, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go first. My needs are more important than those of the collective. I don't care about anybody else. I'm just going to do what I feel like. That's a very, very Indian mindset, especially from North and East India. It's a hugely annoying thing, but that's what they do. Because you live in, you know, Indians live in a very noisy society, very effusive society, they think nothing of using the horn for communication. In Western societies, you only use the horn to warn people of danger or to express your displeasure at other people. In India, people don't check their mirrors when they're driving. So they don't look at their left and right wing mirrors when they're changing lanes. They just change. And the only way to let somebody know that he's drifting out of his lane and into your lane, assuming the lane is even defined, which it usually isn't, is to blow your horn and let him know via sound that he's doing something stupid. And this adds up over the course of just a 30-minute road journey, where if you try to be a good driver and you try to obey the rules of the road and you try to stick to your lane and use turn signals and drive carefully and considerately without trying to destroy your car's suspension by just driving over potholes, you're going to be pushed aside. You're going to be shoved out of the way. You're going to be treated like a moron. If you drive down a side road in India, the level of stupidity is so endemic that you get a roadworks project that digs up half the road in order to lay water pipes to supply fresh water. Well, that's a good thing, right? I mean, those water pipes are going to improve the life for the average poor person in that area, which is fine. So that's all well and good, except that those water pipes should have been laid in 5 years ago. And now that they've been laid in, they tore up half the road, literally, you know, cut the size, the width of the road in half. So now you've got, you've gone from a sort of kind of two-lane country road down to three-quarters of a lane. And you've got these big buses trying to drive down those roads full of passengers. And these roads are now one-way streets, not two-way. Which means that you're stopped in order to let buses pass, and then you start up, and then somebody else has to stop on the other side. There's no traffic signal regulating it. There's no policeman to tell you when to stop and when to go. And the entire reason why this has happened is because the road surface was not redone after the pipes were laid in. So you've got this very crooked, very bumpy half of the road, which is just completely dug up and has had a very poor job of replacing the dirt and the brick over the pipes. And you've got the other side of the road full of potholes. So because the roads here are covered in asphalt, they're not concrete roads. So that is just the start of your journey. I mean, that level of stupid has already imposed a significant burden upon you in order to get anything productive done. Your time, your effort is not valued. So if you're rushing to get to work, now all of a sudden you have this additional friction added in to your day, which means that you are less productive, you have less time to get things done, you are in a much more foul mood when you get to wherever you're going. And again, this is just the start of the journey. You go, you keep driving, you get onto the main roads, let's say, the big bypasses and flyovers and toll roads and such. And you start to drive, and you use your turn signals, and, you know, you do whatever is necessary to maintain the speed limit. Okay, you observe the speed limit, fine. People break the speed limits all the time, anywhere around the world. Speed limits are the most stupidly ridiculous idea in a lot of ways, because most of the time, they aren't enforceable. That's just the hard reality. I mean, speed cameras don't do anything much to save lives. Speeding in and of itself is rarely the cause of real accidents. I mean, if you watch back in the days when Top Gear was still a great show, back when the three Wazzaks were running it, they used to talk all the time about how speed cameras don't really do anything to save lives. 4% of accidents on rural country roads in Britain, according to one study, were due to speed. The other 96% were due to darkness, cyclists, bad weather conditions. Not speed. People weren't speeding. Because the reality is, which government apparatchiks never figure out, that if you leave people mostly alone, actually, they generally behave themselves. This doesn't occur to most government employees. If you just leave people be and let them do their own thing, they're generally not going to behave like complete raging lunatics. At least they wouldn't in a civilized country. In the dirt world, that's a whole different story, because in a civilized country, there's a social compact that says you will not behave a certain way. And there are plenty of exceptions. I mean, Japan is one of the most highly civilized countries anywhere in the world. But it's very common to come home on the Tokyo Metro at 5 p.m. and see hordes of drunk businessmen, like completely shit-faced. Why? Because the culture in Japan says that you drink as hard as you work. So you go out, you know, after work is done at 5 p.m., you go out with your boss because you've been in the office since 8 o'clock in the morning, and you go out with your boss and you get plastered for the next 3 hours, and then you go back on the Tokyo subway, and it's bonkers. You just see shit-faced, shit-canned businessmen acting like complete lunatics in Tokyo, on the Tokyo subway. My sister told me about this, and she, you know, we were having this exact debate about civilized norms, and I said, yeah, look, I get that. The point is that most of the time, people act according to their social norms and conventions, and in civilized countries, those social norms and conventions are quite strong, which is true. They are. Once you break out of that, the confines of those civilized norms, and you go to countries where they don't apply so much anymore, and it's a whole different story. The rules change. So when you're in India and you're driving on the roads, as I said, you face this constant frictional slowdown of your processes. I mean, you're on the freeway and you're driving. People are speeding around you. People are making a nuisance of themselves, weaving in and out of lanes, which forces you to slow down and forces your blood pressure to rise because you're just so shit scared of getting hit. And the thing to remember is, in India, it's not the car lengths. It's not about staying car lengths away from each other. It's about staying inches away from each other. When you're side by side with a car, as long as your mirrors aren't touching the other car or the other car's mirrors aren't touching you, that's a good enough gap. That's a safe gap according to Indian mindset. That's their way of thinking. When you are following a car at speed, tailgating is fine. It's to be expected. I mean, you can have trucks tailgating you, big, huge lorries loaded with junk, spewing exhaust out the back. And that's perfectly okay for them to tailgate you. Never mind that if you have to do a sudden stop, I mean, you're dead, basically. Everything is done according to the lowest common denominator. So, you know, India is the home of mass-produced, really shoddy, cheap cars. China's probably even worse. China's definitely even worse in this regard. But if you get into an Uber in India, in most parts of India, at least in North India, North and East India, you're going to find that you're going to find that they're typically like Suzuki Swift equivalents with very bad suspension. The seatbelts in the back don't work. Seatbelts in the front work, but only because of government mandates. None of the windows are electric, except maybe the driver's side window. There are no luxuries or amenities of any kind. There's one airbag just for the driver, and it's kind of sketchy about whether or not that even works. There are no real safety features, just an eggshell of a car, and will act like an eggshell when hit. None of the government regulations and rules that make European cars and American cars actually kind of over-engineered exist in the dirt world. It doesn't occur to them that this would be necessary. So you're going about your day trying to be a good citizen and obey the rules, because if you're a Westerner trained in Western norms, that's what you expect. You know, you try to act like a sensible road user. Can't do it. You can't do it. Because at every turn, you're going to be stymied by the locals who insist on cutting you off and weaving in and out of traffic and making your life miserable. Why? Because that's what's done there. It is a stupidity tax, as I called it. This is stupid behavior. It's objectively stupid. It's objectively ridiculous. And it imposes a massive tax on everyone else, but that's okay because it's an externality. It's imposed upon you by somebody else, but the other person doesn't pay the cost of that stupidity. With the end result, however, that everybody ends up paying the cost for that stupidity. Everybody ends up disgruntled, unproductive, unhappy, because everybody realizes that, you know, these rules are meant to be broken. These rules, you know, don't make any sense, and therefore, since nobody enforces them and they don't make any sense anyway, why not just break them? And that stupidity manifests itself at every level of society. I'm just talking about road users now, but what about public transport? Well, if you look at the way public transport works are done in, let's say, Calcutta or in any other major North Indian cities, you'll find that they're building, let's say, a metro rail system. In Calcutta, they've been building a metro system for, 7 years now. Actually, it's been in progress for 20 years. But various communist governments, I'm not joking about that, various communist state-level governments used to keep stealing the money or holding up the funds because it wasn't, you know, proletarian enough or whatever. It didn't benefit the people of the countryside, et cetera, even though it was designed specifically for the state, for the city, not the state. But over the last 7 years or so, there's been a big Circle Line metro system that they've been trying to build to compete with cities like Hyderabad, Delhi, and Bombay. And they've been unable to complete it because the work ethic is just not there. The snarls and traffic congestion make it impossible for workers to show up on time. The unbelievable heat of summer makes it next to impossible to get anything done during much of the day. And then there's the fact that the way that they're building this system is colossally disruptive to traffic. Up and down the eastern side of the city, there's something called the Eastern Metropolitan Bypass. And it's the only space wide enough for a metro system to be built, because if you try to build it anywhere else, essentially you're going to be building over people's houses, and people don't want that. So you have to build in the middle of the road. But if you build in the middle of the road, you introduce gigantic traffic complications, because you've got support pylons and pillars planted square in the middle of two lanes of traffic going, you know, in the same direction. So in order to accommodate this support structure, traffic has to be diverted around the base of the pylon, which makes absolutely no sense and actually introduces, particularly at rush hour, huge snarls and congestion and tailbacks. Again, it's a stupid, stupid, stupid design. But the government, the people in charge aren't the ones paying the tax for that stupidity. It's a tax upon the ordinary people. At every level, what you're going to find is that throughout the dirt world, throughout any, pretty much any third world country, the inefficiencies and graft and corruption and misery introduced all create this tax upon people. And I would estimate that the tax on productivity, on hard work, on ingenuity, discipline, work ethic, and so on, is well north of 30%. So if you look at the actual Indian tax structure, Indians pay, depending on their income level, a progressive series of taxes. And I think the top income tax bracket, which actually quite a lot of people fall into, is 30% plus some various surcharges, so you end up paying 33%. That's income tax, by the way. Now, if you add on to that the GST, the VAT that the Indian government passed some time ago, you're now paying a tax on consumption as well as on income. So the VAT comes to, I believe, an additional 10%, if not 20% outright, in some cases. And then on top of that, you end up paying special taxes and duties on, you pay sin taxes, essentially, on alcohol, tobacco, and a few other products. So if you actually look at the total level of taxation across everything, for the most productive elements of society, you know, the ones that actually work hard, the ones that generate all the income, those people are actually being taxed at well over 40 to 50% in some cases of their income. 33%, 30 to 33% gone in income taxes. Okay? And those are taxes that you have to pay no matter where your money comes from. So let's say you're an Indian living in India and you earn your salary, like your paid you're repatriating money earned from some other country. So let's say, which is the case for a lot of what are called non-resident Indians, NRIs, which are essentially Indians who have Indian citizenship but don't ordinarily reside in India. A lot of them have started coming back because they see that India is booming and the West was booming. India's actually in something of an economic slump right now. And the West is kind of slowing down significantly. And this trend really accelerated during the Obama years because, of course, Obama didn't know jack shit about how to manage an economy. But during that time, a lot of Indians came back to India, and a lot more Indians are coming back now because of the policies of, bear with me now, this is going to be a mouthful, His Most Illustrious, Noble, August, Benevolent, and Legendary Celestial Majesty, the God Emperor of Mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, all hail the God Emperor, because of his policies. And for those of you who think I'm, for the tiny minority of you who think I'm making fun of Donald Trump, you could not be more wrong. I've got a t-shirt in my cupboard right now that says Trump Slide 2016. I am a huge fan of the Donald. His policies, which made getting work visas much harder for Indian graduates of American universities, and especially for Indian graduates of technical schools here who would come to India on H-1Bs and basically outsource American jobs, that has become much less common now because of the crackdown by the God Emperor's administration to make this more difficult, which I wholeheartedly, completely, totally support. Even though it actually made life very difficult for me, and continues to make life very difficult for me. But a lot of Indians are coming back now, and they're realizing, oh shit, I'm getting paid my pension, or my Social Security fund, in the US, and from my US bank account, and now I need to repatriate it, I need to bring it back to sit in India. I mean, I need to wire the money back to my Indian account. And bam, they're getting smacked with a 30% tax rate. It's like, what the hell? Because they're already paying a significant amount in taxes in the US on those earnings. Now they're having to repatriate those earnings to India, or expatriate them, rather. And they're now paying taxes on those earnings. And on top of that, they now have to deal with the inconvenience and frustration and stupidity and just like daily grind of living in a dirt world country. And the just sheer stupidity, venality, corruption, nepotism, cronyism of the place makes life so much more difficult that it essentially imposes an additional 20 to 40% tax rate on you. Now, I think, I hope, you begin to understand why it is that places like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, you know, a lot of these South Asian countries, a lot of the Southeast Asian countries to some extent, are still so poor because of the stupidity tax. Now I think you understand why African countries are still so poor, why a number of South American countries are still so poor. Because the stupidity endemic at every level of society, whether it's caused by IQ being too low, or whether it's caused by corruption and graft, is a massive burden upon the productive elements of those societies. You can't get past it. And it doesn't matter if you're here as, you know, in India as a multi-millionaire. If you are, your life is going to be significantly better than that of most people. But the daily grind of dealing with this idiocy, of dealing with horrible traffic due to appalling infrastructure, which never gets fixed, never gets solved, of uncivil driving habits, which take out so much time from your day, of strikes that can be called at any particular point in time, just because people feel like it, which is highly disruptive to life and makes life unbearable, of the extreme heat caused, you know, by horrible Indian summers, and the resulting strains on power generation. I mean, Bombay is one of the richest city, probably the richest city in India, I think. I could be wrong about that, but I think it's the wealthiest because it's the business center of India, obviously. Bombay has trouble keeping the lights on sometimes, particularly during summer, because they don't have enough power generation in that city. Calcutta doesn't have that problem, weirdly enough, because Calcutta's mayor and West Bengal's chief ministers, throughout, you know, all of the many decades of communist misrule, managed to chase away all the heavy industry. So there is basically almost no heavy industry left in Calcutta. All that's left is the hospital sector, the medical sector. And that, while that is significant, it doesn't draw anything like as much of a strain on the power grid as factories and shops and, you know, heavy industry, of which there is almost none. So the result is that life in these places becomes really depressing because it's not just a tax on income or productivity, it's also a tax on psychological well-being. And the result is that you get an enervated, lazy in a different sense, you know, not like in a physically hard-working sense, because there are a lot of people in India who work crazy hard. I mean, physically, just very, very hard. But they work hard, they don't work smart. They work really hard just to survive. And that's the key, you know, so many of them are just in survival mode. Because they can't move up, they can't aspire to anything higher. And believe it or not, things are actually vastly better now than they were 20 years ago. Why? Because 20 years ago, India was a truly socialist country and had essentially bankrupted its foreign exchange reserves, had depleted them completely in trying to defend its currency and couldn't do it anymore, and had to liberalize, had to open up its markets because it was a closed-off socialist economy with a failing industrial base, and was keeping hundreds of millions of its people in extreme poverty. You know, there was a time when India's population was essentially a tiny coterie of very, very rich people up the top. You know, the top 1% or 0.1% even of the population was very wealthy. And they had trouble paying off their taxes because the top tax rates were so high. They were like 90%+. On top of which there were wealth taxes and other fees and licenses that they had to acquire. The effective tax rate was over 100% on people like J.R.D. Tata, who had to keep selling off part of his assets every year just to keep the government happy. That's how ridiculous it was. There was effectively no middle class, or very, very, very small sliver of middle class. And then there was this gigantic, massive, really, you know, poor to desperately poor people below them. The middle class didn't really exist at the time. There were some of them, but not many. You know, 100 million or so, perhaps. Which sounds like a lot, but in a country of a billion people, it's not that much. What changed 20 years ago was economic liberalization, which brought forth huge benefits in terms of, that wasn't me, by the way, that sound you just heard was a chair being moved, which brought forth huge benefits in terms of, you know, income and opportunities, which really helped create a middle class. So the middle class expanded at an enormous clip. I mean, so 400 million Indians now are what you would call middle class. So this was a tremendous achievement, but it's still not enough, because that middle class is still fighting the tremendous inertia of another 500 million or so, or actually more than that, still about 600, 700 million or so really poor people. Again, still very poor to desperately poor. And you still have an expanded, but still exceptionally small coterie of extremely rich and wealthy people who don't have to deal with these problems, but, you know, they can get away from them. They can insulate themselves from it to some extent, but their wealth still doesn't buy the kind of lifestyle and ease that a middle-class person in many ways can enjoy in the USA. I mean, you look at the average retired Floridian, you know, in Boca Raton or, let's say, somewhere in Arizona, you know, in Scottsdale, perhaps. And you look at the average retiree's life, where he's got good roads, reliable internet, reliable power, reliable water, utilities work, he can drive wherever he wants to, he doesn't have to deal with crowded, congested conditions. Life for him is pretty easy. That's a middle-class retired guy. That's his life. He lives a better life than people in the top 1% of the income strata in an underdeveloped country. Think about that for a moment. And now I hope you understand what I mean when I say that this is your future in the West if very harsh and painful reforms are not taken. The Western nations are letting in hordes and hordes of dirt worlders under the mistaken belief that immigration is a good thing. It's not. Dirt worlders themselves will tell you that they don't want foreigners in their own countries. Indians themselves will tell you they don't want Bangladeshis crossing their borders illegally. They have 200,000 people sitting on their border right now, armed police and troops, sitting on the border with Bangladesh right now, with orders to arrest and detain and possibly kill smugglers and traffickers. Okay? That's a fact. That's basically equivalent to a fifth of the entire U.S. military sitting on a relatively narrow stretch of border to stop people from entering illegally. And they still can't stop them. But large parts of the West are now turning into the third world. They're now turning into the very same hellholes that those third worlders came to escape. This is your future. This is a future of where you have a combination of extraordinarily high taxation caused by idiotic progressive policies combined with extreme stupidity and the very tangible, probably measurable economic impact that that has, where you are stuck dealing with a regression in productivity, in output, in intelligence, in multiple avenues of life, simply because people are too dumb to do anything about it. That's your future, unless you change things very quickly. And let me just add one quick addendum before I sign off. Not every Asian country is like this, like what I've described. Not every African country is like what I've described. There are African countries which have done tremendous work in fixing themselves. If you go to Indonesia, which is a third world country, or you go to Malaysia, which is kind of up, you know, getting developing, but is still in many ways a third world country, particularly in Borneo, which is very underdeveloped compared to Western Malaysia. You will still find these problems are there, but in Indonesia in particular, the culture is very different. So it's not universally true that the third world is just full of stupidity and rampant corruption. It's there. I mean, you'll find it all over Indonesia. But it's not, it's, some places are better than others. Let me put it that way. Some places are better than others and some places are worse than others. I don't like the UAE very much, for instance. I've spent time in Dubai. Dubai is a first world city, but I wouldn't want to move there. I mean, unless I was being paid a lot of money to do it. Because it's just, culturally, it's not a nice place to be, in all honesty. So maybe I'll expand on that in a future podcast, but right now I'm out of time. So thank you very much for listening. If you, as I said, if you have not subscribed already, please do so. I do have to address a point that one of my readers made about libertarianism, and I'll do that probably next week, or in a post somewhere. But in the meantime, stay well. If you have any comments or thoughts to add, please add them in the comments section here on SoundCloud, or head over to my blog and add your comments there. And I will see you on the next one, hopefully in a more timely fashion. This is Didact, and this has been Didactic Mind, episode 12, The Stupidity Tax.